everyone. Welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I wanted to put in a quick plug at the beginning of the show here for a recent series of interviews that I've been doing, or conversations or discussions with my mom. We just released part 3 this last week, which I consider is one of the most important and also personal videos I think I've ever made. And I want people to see it. It's about an hour long, this third part, and it is about disconnection, and it's about how me and my mom successfully did not get disconnected. I don't think that side of the story is really told often enough, or really much at all. There's tons and tons of stories of disconnection, tragic stories out there about the shunning that Scientology does. But there are people, I think, I'm one of them, who succeeded in not getting disconnected from their family. I lost a lot of people when I left Scientology, including a fiancé and friends that I'd had for decades. So it was no walk in the park for me to leave Scientology, and I don't look at it as some big success. But I do consider it a big success, and I'm very thankful that I still have my family. And we talk about that, my mom and I do, in this interview, and we go into a lot of information about that. So if you haven't seen that, check it out. And also, just going to plug my Sensibly Speaking podcast, because that's my forum and opportunity to talk about just about anything, current events mostly, news topics, but also we do interviews and we do other topical subjects there on that show. And I get a chance to be a critical thinker and put my foot in my mouth. And then come back the next week and go, well, I wasn't quite critical enough on that one, and we have a lot of fun with that, and I do that with my friend Ruth McLeod. So anyway, also encourage you to check that one out too. So for this week, let's go ahead and get on with your questions, because I got a few of them to answer this week. Misbehaving. I notice in these conversations with your mom that your mother's language is still laced with Scientology's, even though she has been away from the church for a long while. I don't get the impression that she has a tendency toward identifying as an indie Scientologist who may still embrace some Scientology principles, and she certainly doesn't seem to want anything to do with the official Church of Scientology. This brings up the concept of recovery in Scientology. Not as in recovering from Scientology, but being recovered back into Scientology. I don't think your mom would ever be able to be recovered, but I do believe that people who are still using the language still have some connection with the subject, even though they may not even be aware of it. You have mentioned in the past that recovery was one of your jobs when you were in the Sea Org, and that you were very good at it. Could you explain how you went about recovering people, and more importantly now, how people can best avoid being recovered back into Scientology? Yeah, I was actually really good at recovering people back into Scientology, meaning I would contact people who had left, who had left the church. And I don't mean people who had been declared suppressive, because you don't talk to them. But I mean just people who had been, you know, mainly public people, of course, who had been doing services, auditing or counseling or the classes. And then they just, you know, got fed up with it, didn't want to do it anymore, they didn't accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, or, you know, somebody screwed with them in the wrong way, and they just said, that's enough of this, and they left. And I would go, you know, I'd get lists of these names of these people, because the church keeps records of them, and I would look them up on the internet, or I'd skip trace their numbers or whatever, somehow I would find them, or find them through friends of theirs who were still Scientologists, you know, who were still around. And I'd somehow try to establish communication with them. And all of this was preceded by a study of their files to find out, not blackmail, but to find out what they were doing that had messed up, that had gone wrong. You know, because when you're in Scientology and you believe in it, then you think the only reason somebody would leave is because something went wrong, because somebody didn't do Scientology properly on them or with them, and you want to find out what that mistake was or what that error was, and you want to get it fixed. And generally that involves trying to get them to come in to get an auditing session where that can be addressed, their upsets can be addressed, and they can be acknowledged for having had something bad happen to them, and or wrong or whatever, you know, without the church ever actually saying, hey, you know what, we totally were wrong and, you know, now we owe you money or something like that. It doesn't go like that. But it goes in such a way that the person does get acknowledged for, you know, something or someone messing up or something like that. And then getting them back on board. Now, in terms of how to do it, those are some of the mechanics of it. But once I would actually, if I could get in front of somebody, and this worked a lot, okay, and this was actually based on some advice from Hubbard. He wrote an issue, I think in the 80s, I think it was 1982 or something. It was a fairly late issue. And there was a piece of information in it that I found very, very helpful, very useful. And I don't know where he got it from or how he came up with it, but basically the piece of information was, if a person is running into or has decided that they are stopped on something, that they've run into a brick wall and they can't go on anymore, the reason for that is because of a failed purpose. They had some desire, some goal, some purpose they were trying to achieve, and they couldn't make it. They didn't make it, and they gave up. And because they gave up, that's where the stops came from, right? Not the other way around. Not that they got stopped and then they got the failed purpose. It was because all stops, he said, come from the failed purpose. It's a little counterintuitive. And I've found in my working with people and recovering them back into Scientology and in other things too, when I'm just helping friends or helping people out, that actually has some truth to it. And the way I would do it, or the way I would use this piece of information, is I would try to get the person, if I could get them to talk to me at all, I would assure them that I was not there to get any money from them. That was always the very first thing, was I'm not here to get money out of you. I don't care if you pay me a dime. That's not what this is about, right? Because that was always a sore spot for people. So I would be very friendly and I would listen very much to everything they had to say, and I truly was interested in what they had to say, and then I would try to find out. I would try to steer the conversation in a direction where I would find out what was it that they were doing Scientology for in the first place. Why did they get involved? Why did they want to do it? What convinced them to get started? What was it that they wanted to handle in the first place? Because pretty much everybody who comes into Scientology comes in because they're trying to handle or deal with some problem or facet of themselves that they don't like or they want to change. I would find out what that was. And I would find out from the person, of course, assuming that that has never been handled. I would then, you know, find out more about that, you know, whatever that problem or situation or thing, you know, fault or frailty or whatever was, and I would get them to talk about it, and then I would say, well, you know, I know that these bad things happened in the course of you trying to accomplish your goals with Scientology, and those things that happened were wrong. I would flat out acknowledge the wrongness of it, and as a representative of the church and as a Sea Org member, right, I had some clout, and so I would really be acknowledging that was wrong. Sometimes I would just be really blunt about it too, you know, just they'd tell me some things that happened to them, you know, somebody asked them for too much money, you know, they were coming to their house at 3 a.m. or they got an auditing session and it went really bad and then nobody said or did anything to fix it and they just were left in the dumps, right? That kind of thing. I mean, all kinds of things happen to people in Scientology. And I'd say, man, that was just totally wrong. Did we screw up? Holy cow, did we mess up, right? I would just totally bluntly, I'd just say, you know, I'd just call it. And I would just try to get that elephant out of the room, You know, I would just try to say, yeah, that was awful. Now, once I could get that elephant out of the room, then I would ask them about, you know, the thing they wanted to handle in the first place, whatever that failed purpose, right? What was that purpose that they had? And I would then say, well, look, we can still accomplish that. We can still make that happen, right? We can still do that. You can still achieve blank, whatever it was that they wanted out of Scientology. And odds are, after I had acknowledged that we had screwed up, and after I acknowledged them for, you know, being good Scientologists who wanted to do Scientology and wanted to achieve whatever purpose they wanted to achieve, they could see that I meant what I said, that I was really honest and earnest about getting them back, and they and I was very friendly. I never yelled at anybody or anything like that. Then I basically was able to convince them that to give us a second chance, right? And then I would go, you know, to the church where they were going to come back into, and I would set everything up so that they got really Cadillac service when they came in, you know, and they got their auditing session, or they got back in the course room and they you know, continued on with their services, and they had a very good experience with it, you know, when they first came back in. And once that was done, you know, they were back on board, and most of them had money that they had already paid the church for services, so we didn't need to get more money out of them right away, and that was the last thing I was interested in doing. I wasn't one of these, you know, greedy, money-hungry people. My job was to just get the body back in the building, right, and get them back on service, and so that's what I did, and that's how I went about doing it. Now, as far as how you would avoid something like that, one, don't talk to them, because some of them are really good. You know, two, get educated, you know, because the ones that I did not succeed with and the ones that I did not get through to were the ones who actually went on the internet, found out what was really going on with Scientology, like for real, and I'd show up and they'd be like, yeah, no, you really don't know what you're talking about, right? And of course, I didn't know what I was talking about because I didn't know what they knew. I didn't know about L. Ron Hubbard. I didn't know about his past. I didn't know about the fact he was a pathological liar. I didn't know about all those things. And so because I didn't know, I was able to honestly do my job, right? But once you do know those things, then somebody comes along and tries to sell you the snake oil, and you know, you're not so interested in buying it anymore. So that's the best remedy I can think of to stop a recovery from happening into Scientology is the truth. So there you go. My Auric. What about if people deliberately want to stay in that state of ignorance for purely egotistical reasons, as physical health, well-being, and so on? So I think this question is pretty much addressed to people who are not coming out of Scientology or acknowledging, you know, things they see that they know are not right and things like that. Or, you know, not just, of course, Scientology. This really applies to anything. And this is actually the battle that we have as critical thinkers, right, is the education of people who don't want to be educated. Critical thinking almost becomes a sales job, you know, of selling somebody the truth. And you almost have to use those kind of techniques in order to get through to people sometimes, because they have these things, these mental reactions to things that we use terms like cognitive dissonance and confirmation bias, and, you know, they think with certain logical fallacies, you know, things like this. We use these terms to describe the thought process of basically not wanting to give up on ideas that you kind of know or suspect aren't really true, but you want to hold on to them anyway. That's the push and pull of our emotion versus our intellect, you know, and it's a battle. And I am constantly fighting that, you know, within myself, and I think we all are, you know. I don't think anybody has a monopoly on the truth or on reason or on skepticism. You know, we know that these things exist, and we try our best to live up to our ideals and the rules and guidelines of them, but we all stumble around in the dark with this because we're human and we have these pesky emotions, you know, and we have these beliefs and these ideas that we have that have no real basis in any real fact, you know. Now, when you get into the subject of willful ignorance or deliberately staying in a state of ignorance, that's denial, you know, and you overcome that by just keep pushing the truth on a person, you know. I mean, if it's worth it, you know, but there's also that question too when you're talking to people who are doing that sort of thing is how much is it worth it? You know, what interest do you have in getting somebody to give up beliefs they have? How destructive are they? You know, we talk about destructive cults, right? Well, they're destructive for a reason. They're destructive because they actually hurt people emotionally, psychologically, financially. You know, they rip apart families and friendships and things like that. Really overtly destructive stuff. And you know, the thought molding and that kind of thing, that's a lot more subtle, you know, because lots of things do that. There, you know, every commercial you see is trying to mold your thoughts. But is it trying to do it in a destructive manner? Is it trying to get you, you know, leading you in a destructive fashion? That's the judgment factor that you have to weigh with all of the various beliefs that you run into with yourself and with other people. So I think really my best answer to these kinds of situations is you have to take it on a case by case basis of what's the cost you know, benefit ratio of you know, trying to change somebody else's life versus leaving them alone to believe whatever they want to believe or think whatever they want to think. You know, that's what you kind of have to weigh on it. And it's, I don't know a better way to answer it except to say it's a sort of a case by case basis, you know. And also, what's good for you might not always be good for somebody else. So I know this is a totally kind of a, you know, I don't mean to come across as in a wishy-washy way. I really mean I'm trying to define tolerance and understanding versus interfering with somebody else's life. You know, do you have to do it? And if you do you have good reason to do it? And if you do, then, you know, good. Then move forward and see what you can do. But you're going to have to do it with care, compassion, and respect, because you won't get through to a person any other way. Anon 8109. Hubbard Scientology gives people a false sense of security, especially in what happens after they die. Letting go of that must be terrifying and maybe impossible for some people, especially if they grew up believing in it. Life with all its pains and suffering can sometimes feel like a free fall into emptiness. Scientology promises that there will be a soft landing, and that provides some comfort to people who believe it. Do you ever miss being comforted by Hubbard's ideas? Do you ever experience mortal terror and emptiness now that you realize there may not be a soft landing? If so, how do you deal with it? Okay, first off, I will say yes, I do miss that, and I miss it every single day. It is very hard to grow up with an idea of personal spiritual immortality and then realize that the person who was selling you that idea was a pathological liar and had no real basis to make those promises. That was very, very, very difficult to accept. And it's taken me a long time to even really get my wits around the idea of accepting it, because I haven't wanted to. I've gone from a position of very, very strong belief in myself as and everybody else as, you know, a spiritual being who goes on from life to life to life, basically a sort of a reincarnation sort of belief, which is what Scientology is part of their dogma. And I didn't have a big fear of death. I didn't have a big fear of horrible things happening to me, because I felt that, in fact, I knew that I was coming back around. So, you know, it would be a loss. It would suck. It might suck to have to experience the pain of dying, but I didn't have any doubt that I was coming back. So after I lost all of my Scientology certainties and sort of started putting it behind me, I had to deal with this sudden void, And I didn't want there to be a void because it was emotionally very uncomfortable. And in fact, not just uncomfortable, it was terrifying. And it still is. I don't feel safe or secure in this knowledge, and it doesn't give me any degree of comfort at all. I have the logical side of me that says, you know, there's no good reason to have any spiritual beliefs because there's no real evidence of it. And yet I have anecdotal experiences and ideas that maybe there are some reasons to hold on to these kind of beliefs, or what I now call hopes. I don't really call them beliefs, I call them hopes, because I hope, you know, that there's more to life than just what we see around us. I feel I have some intellectual reasons for believing such things, mainly in the progress of science and the history and philosophy of science. Science is not a completed end of story right now, in fact, very far from it, and anybody who believes that science has got everything figured out is completely delusional. So, and being what I call a scientific dogmatist, you know, because science does not have things figured out fully. So I have good reason to still have hopes, I think. But as far as how I deal with it, you know, I can't ever fall back to my Scientology beliefs. And it really sucks because they were very comforting. So now what I've been working on is sort of trying to practice what I preach by educating myself. And specifically about death and about, you know, dying. It's a very uncomfortable subject for me. You know, I have a lot of goals and things I want to accomplish in this life. And I'm not cool with the idea of just dying tomorrow. You know, that's not something I want to accept, even though it could happen. So I'm trying to get myself comfortable with that idea by, you know, watching media, you know, entertainment, reading books, that sort of thing, talking to people about it. And that's been helpful. You know, it's been a gradual, slow progress for me, you know, because I think that's one of the most difficult things I've had to give up. And I'm still a work in progress, like I've always said. And I think many other people are too. I think the real failing of life is when we stop being a work in progress, you know. So that's how I'm dealing with it, is I'm not in denial about it. I'm just trying to get educated. And I don't accept anybody telling me how things are when it comes to the afterlife or comes to what things happen to us when we die, because the truth of the matter is, no one knows. No one. And there's lots of reasons to believe that nothing happens to us, and there's some reasons to believe that maybe something does happen to us. There are valid reasons to believe that. And, you know, so I guess we'll all find out when it happens. And maybe as science progresses forward, I'm hoping that there will be further advances that might actually give us some tangible evidence and answers in that direction. And I hold out the idea that science can do that eventually. So we'll see how soon that comes along. And in the meantime, I'll just keep working at it. Mr. Bazzini, there have been some news articles re Tom Cruise moving to St. Hill in England. Most people consider it bunk. I do not, as he could be in some turmoil seeing his daughter Suri in the press growing up, and this issue is coming up in auditing. When Miscavige hears of this, he could have decided to sit down with Tom and give him a grandiose title such as European Director of the Board, so as to get Tom very focused on being much more of a leader rather than just a figurehead, getting him to work more on expanding Scientology and, by default, dragging him further down the rabbit hole. Would you consider this a possibility? I would consider the idea you're presenting as a possibility without going into the specifics of it. Tom Cruise is definitely not moving into St. Hill Manor in England. He's not taking a position with the church because he doesn't have to. You know, he's already got a position in the church. He's this opinion leader within the church. What he says, he gets. And what he wants, he gets. What he says, people do. You know, people in the Sea Org and in Scientology call him Sir. I mean, it's ludicrous. Tom Cruise takes horrible advantage of his position within that group. And David Miscavige, of course, puts him in a position where he can take advantage of that. David Miscavige is the one who orders people to listen to and follow Tom Cruise's directions and things like that, and demands that they give Tom Cruise respect and that sort of thing, even though he's done absolutely nothing to deserve any such thing. So as far as this idea, though, of Miscavige getting Tom into the fold, you know, and giving him, you know, listening to his ideas and getting advice and direction from him and that sort of thing, I think Miscavige does that. I think, I don't know that he particularly gives Tom Cruise's advice any real, you know, in Miscavige's own head, I don't think he particularly listens to Tom Cruise as though Tom Cruise is somebody who should be telling him what to do. Miscavige is much too egotistical for that. But I think he does that in order to pump up Tom Cruise, right? And I think that David Miscavige would have no problem doing that. And Tom is obviously fallen just head over heels, full bore, dived all the way in the deep end of Scientology. He doesn't necessarily need to go further down the rabbit hole. He's about as far down as you can go. And I don't think he's ever coming out. I really believe that he's never going to see the error of his ways. You know, I read an article the other day. He hasn't seen his daughter in like 900 days or something. I mean, that is insane. And it's not because he can't. You know, nobody in Scientology is telling Tom Cruise that he can't see his daughter. He's doing that. And that's what I mean when I look at that, and that's what makes me evaluate that he's as far down the rabbit hole as you can get. And it's a pathetic, horrible, awful place to be. And that's where he's at. So yeah, I consider your scenario a possibility, even though I might nitpick some of the specifics of it. Hey, it's time for Flash Answers. Riggs BF. After watching your video with an ex-Jehovah's Witness on comparing and contrasting the two different cults, have you ever considered doing another video with other former cult members, perhaps a former Mormon or an ex-Mooney? Absolutely, I'd be more than happy to do, and I'm sure in the future I will do, interviews with members of other former members of other cult groups, definitely. Rob Newbold. For the former members that are blown and outspoken, is it a point of pride that Scientology puts out trash talk about you, or is it something that you worry about? I don't know, maybe a little bit of both, you know? It's certainly within the critics' world, we acknowledge that Scientology is going to do that or could do that. And somehow I've dodged that bullet, and I'm, you know, not upset about that. I don't have any burning desire to be attacked by Scientology. But, you know it could come any day. And I don't know that there's a lot of worry about it, and I don't know that there's a lot of pride in it. I think it's just, you know, Scientology's reactions to what I say are the least important part of what I'm doing with my life. I don't really care what they have to say about what I'm doing, because their opinion doesn't mean anything to me, you know, and I think that really is what it comes down to for me, as far as what Scientology is going to say about me. Niv Tom, do you believe that if a reform was to happen and the church was turned into a business offering courses and therapy auditing, it could be of help and turn from evil to good, including offering more affordable prices and the cancellation of Sea Org and other draconian management organizations? You know, I think in the past I've said something along those lines, but at this point, no, I don't really think so. Not really. Scientology just needs to go away. Because if you reinvent Scientology into something else, you're just cherry picking from it. Scientology is a thing. It is a destructive thing. It's something that L. Ron Hubbard invented. He wrote all these various issues and rules and guidelines and policies about it. And the whole thing is Scientology. Independent Scientologists cherry pick the parts they like out of it and call it Scientology. But it's not. It's not Scientology what they're doing. Because Scientology is a whole system, and it includes the ethics and the justice and the declares and the suppressive person things and the disconnection and all of that bad stuff, right? And the Office of Special Affairs and the justice system. All of that is just as much Scientology as the auditing and the classes. It's all one big thing. So, you know, to say that you can strip out the parts that you think are good and that's Scientology, well, okay, but it's not. So, you know, it's something else. And that's why, you know, I think Hubbard called them, you know, squirrels, you know, because they're splinter groups. And, you know, they can call themselves Scientologists, but, you know, I think there's a little bit of denial going on there. So anyway, that's sort of my take on that. All right. And so we have reached the end of another episode. Thank you very much for listening and watching all the way through here. I'm going to be in Los Angeles on May 1st at the Center for Inquiry, and that will be, the link is below, and you can come out, and I will do a book signing there, and we will be giving, me and Jamie DeWolf will be doing some speaking, and I think that's going to be a lot of fun. That's on a Sunday morning, afternoon time, so come check that out, and if you haven't done so, go ahead and check out my other videos on this channel. Give me, you know, think about subscribing if you haven't, and also check out my book on Amazon.com. Thanks a lot, and I will see you guys next week.